This is Lewis Jukes, recorded at his home in Great Ayton by Chris Alden Lee on the 22nd of May 2010. Lewis Jukes, Part 1.
Lewis Jukes, born in Durban, South Africa, on the 14th of January 1942.
And what were your parents, Lewis?
My parents came from different backgrounds. My mother was from a farm, fairly remote by modern standards. And my father lived in grew up in Durban, the biggest town in the area. And his background was in retail, selling, that kind of thing.
And what would you say was your first awareness of the existence of the Antarctic?
We learned about that kind of thing at school. I suppose this was the kind of lessons they thought should be taught to pupils in the empire. But I can remember, although we were told that there were several reasons why Amundsen reached the pole first, the implication was that they were sneaky reasons and not good planning. And I can actually remember looking it up in the encyclopedia after that and seeing a picture, a drawing of the Scotsmen surveying themselves in there, and I couldn't really understand why it was so flat. I mean, I didn't expect a pole, but I thought there'd be something.
Did you, at that point, have a desire to go yourself? Did it inspire you to the Antarctic? I mean,
not particularly, but it was one of many things that did intrigue me. Travel, far-off places, unusual places, that kind of thing. Yes, it was just one of many.
You chose to study geology, which is not an obvious choice.
At school, they gave us tests to do, which gave various scores, and then the careers teacher would come along and say, this suggests you should be this and that. And I think it was a dispensing chemist or a meteorologist, they said for me. But for some reason, she said, I've just had some leaflets, and here's one on geology, and I think it'll appeal to you. And by golly, it did. I looked at that, and ever since then, yes.
What was it about geology which did appeal to you? Do you remember?
Not quite sure, I suppose. partly learning about things which were already there, which you can see around you, but knowing an awful lot more about them, and just how much they can tell you further back, the origin of the Earth, fossils, who knows what.
You had a fairly eminent professor, Professor King, who was one of your lecturers.
Professor King. Yes. Continental drift was one of the big debating points, well, it had been for decades, but the general thing was that America rejected it completely. Britain was half and half. There tended to be stronger support in the southern continents because the geological evidence was stronger and you could actually see it in front of you. If you were elsewhere, you had to read about it and then you doubted the authors. He published an awful lot. Among other things, he managed to wangle a trip with Bass to Fossil Bluff because Antarctica was one of the continents that was important in this, although he went to West Antarctica, which is the wrong part. East Antarctica is where the evidence is.
Was Professor King instrumental in your joining FIDS, as it was then?
He was indeed. when he was in Britain for that, to arrange that trip, the head of the geology in those days was a chap called Raymond Adey, who was one of his past students. And Adey said to him, we could, if you want to send people across, either doctors, and that was simply because they always had trouble in recruiting doctors, or one or two geologists. The idea was that if they did find this evidence for continental drift, they would recognise the beds and the fossils there as being similar to those in South Africa. So King came back, called in two of us from our class of five, final year, and suggested this to us, said, he could wangle it if we wanted. And we both nodded dutifully and went out. And around the corner, the other chap burst out laughing and said, this is ridiculous. We could get jobs paying good money. I said, I thought it was a good idea. Anyway, so I followed it up and he didn't. And that led me to Britain and then to the Antarctic.
Well, you applied, didn't you? And was that a smooth passage?
Well, yes, it was a little bit tangled. I wondered whether I could do it from South Africa, but I was told no, I had to be in Britain to apply in the first place. So I had to get across there, and AD said he could wangle a job for me at the university. Getting across was difficult. My father was starting a new business, and money was tight there. I had none. And I looked around, and the money of those days, it was hard to find any way of getting there for less than £100. I looked at working my way across on a ship, but that was just when the first work permits, that was it, for Commonwealth immigrants had been introduced. And suddenly ships and were being careful who they took, for fear that if they took someone across who didn't have the right permit, they might have the responsibility of taking them back. And I actually got a work permit, and King lent me £100, which just covered the fare on the cheapest airline. And I got there, paid him back at the end of the year.
And so you got to have your interview?
I got there for the interview. I worked for quite some months in Birmingham there, which gave me an opportunity to get my background. And there was the odd panic there, in that I'd already got photographs that said bring two passport-type photographs to the interview. In fact, AD had warned me in advance to get them. And on the train down, I checked my things and I hadn't got them. I'd forgotten them. But I'd always been told in South Africa, if you're in London and you're stuck, ask a bobby. So when I got there for the interview, they were running late. So I nipped outside, asked a bobby. He told me where there was a fast studio. I had to go down the tube and up the other side. They took my photo, but they said it won't be ready for an hour. So back I went, and they were even later. And they said, did you mind? I said, no, not at all. Dashed down, got these, and I presented them, still smelling of fixer. But they didn't say anything about it. Probably saw the funny side.
So do you think at any point that they were doing any kind of psychological testing on you before you went south, or was it all a bit more casual than that, this interview?
Oh, no, it was casual. And also, there was, I forget when it was, it was some years later, someone saw an interview in a magazine with Bill Sloman, who was the personnel officer then, and they asked, how do you find people? And he said, you know, there are the various routes, you know, universities, journals where we advertise, but we know people who know people. And
Professor Keane.
Indeed. You know, but when someone read this out in the Birmingham to the other geologists, everyone chuckled and said, yes, you know, there's plenty of evidence of that. So I think they prided themselves on the ability to spot people.
Did you have a theory about why they selected raw recruits, rawly or newly graduated recruits?
I think because they were more flexible. Bearing in mind, as I said, you had to there, you know, go to Birmingham and so on. I think if you tried to get an established academic, you know, they would be less flexible, either in moving there or if they had family or established, or they. I just think it was more convenient back then, and also. I think there was it was seen more as an adventure, rather than a purely academic. I mean, I'm not trying to downplay the academic side, but it was pretty physical getting the academic side done. It was probably just easier and cheaper salaries.
Of course, yes. Was there a bit of a gap between being told yes and sailing?
Right, there were, I can't remember how long, I could check from my letters, but there was probably a couple of months. And they recruited me, another chap had turned up like me, a chap called Mike Ayling, and he had, a month or two later, he worked as a research assistant too, so-called, at the university. And I don't know how he had been wangled. They then hired, three others. Mike Thompson, who was actually a graduate of Birmingham University, and two with Irish connections, Guy Stubbs and Julian Pagella. So they all turned up there. and five of us. There were various courses we had to do. There was survey. We had to do this in case we had to do our own surveying. And in fact, it was a bit of a free holiday. The Lickey Hills are to the south of Birmingham, not far from where we were. And there's a golf course there, but it seems to be a public golf course. It's used as a public park. People walk and take their dogs through it. And we were sent there to map this. We spent a lot of time just sitting back and watching the squirrels and all sorts. Anyway, and then there was a so-called Cambridge Conference, which is a thing in itself. This is where they bring together all the new recruits for a week in Cambridge. And you get instruction on various topics. And, well, after that, there are two survey ships which went down. There was the John Biscoe and the Shackleton. And for Halley Bay, they chartered a Danish one, and which was the Kistedan at the time. Now, that was more expensive. It was reputed to cost £360 a day charter. This was when our salaries down there were £550 a year. So it was quite a substantial sum. And so they sent them down at the last minute. And so we left in early December, whereas the others had left a month or two earlier. And yes, there was quite a delay in prepared bits and pieces.
Was there any health and safety training or preparation for the conditions?
There was nothing other than the Cambridge Conference. There was probably something on safety. I can't remember whether there was. Oh dear.
You don't have to remember. That's all right.
No. This is an. I've written it down anyway, so people are going to see it one day anyway. At the end of the Cambridge Conference, we were told that our lot this year had been the worst and most disgraceful group they had ever seen. And, various things. They implied that there's no time to recruit more people, to tip you lot out. Although it was only a small number. Now, there were two things that had precipitated this. The one was the first talk was an introduction, I think by Fuchs, probably, something like that, formal. The next one was shown as physiology. And the chap turned up there, a doctor, and said, right, it says physiology, but this is on venereal disease. And he then proceeded to list all the things you could catch in Montevideo, where he said, you'll find it unfamiliar in that it is an active and above-ground industry. You'll have girls coming straight up to you and propositioning you. And, all these things you can catch there. None of these can be cured in time to send you down and back again. You catch anything and you will be brought back. Furthermore, we might enforce clauses of your contract. And there were certain clauses saying that, that if you, for some reason, you had to be sent back, you could be charged with, I think, your transport or the costs of sending out a replacement and all sorts. Anyway, as I said, he gave quite gruesome descriptions of what you could catch there. And some people said this, and it was an appropriate time. We heard funny sounds at the back. Some of the fellows had been drinking too much before this. And there were a couple vomiting in the back of the audience, at the back of the hall, through this lecture. Surprisingly, they didn't stop or tip them out or anything. The guy just glared up there each time there was another gasp and a splatter. And weird. Anyway, that wasn't enough. Whether it was the same or different people, I don't know. But we then, one thing on the itinerary was, or schedule, was a tea party in Sir Vivian's back garden, which was just across the road, virtually. And some fellows went into the local pub, looked around at the local girls there and said, hey, you know, we're off to a party. Who wants to come with us? And they turned up with some questionable females there, which was, you know, not what Sir Vivian felt he'd invited into his garden. So, we went down as the most disgraceful ones they'd seen.
Did the dangers of Montevideo pay off, or did some of the Finns ignore it?
To the best of my knowledge, everyone observed it closely. Not so the crew. One of them was reported to be getting antibiotic injections from the bosun after we left there. And what amused us was that he'd been getting them all the way down the Atlantic from his adventures in Southampton. And he'd only just cured the last infection, and there wasn't enough in the system to protect him there. Mm. So he obviously knew the routine.
When you arrived in the Antarctic, was it? I presume you went in via Stanley, or what happened?
Right. We sailed from Southampton. Our first stop was Montevideo for a day or two. Then to Stanley for a few days and picking up kit. Then to South Georgia for a couple of days. And in South Georgia, we met, I think it was the Shackleton, one of the survey boats, and there was much changing of personnel. We picked up a couple of people, including Sir Vivian, people important enough to fly down rather than spend, you know, 3 weeks wallowing all that down at 12 knots down the Atlantic. And we picked up Sir Vivian there and we transferred him and he went off to the peninsula. And from South Georgia to Halley Bay, and it was the same on the way back. So, you know, all I saw was Halley Bay, a stop each way at South Georgia, a stop each way in Stanley.
What were your first impressions of the Antarctic, having waited, I think, nearly 2 years to get there?
Depends what you mean by the Antarctic. If you mean the ocean, two things happened. One was that those who were keen to take photos tended to stay up, you know, and as each night got later, and bearing in mind that in South Africa I wasn't used to long late nights because in a latitude of 30 degrees, if the sun was still up at 8 o'clock, that was late. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't quite realise I was staying up, you know, not going to bed until it got dark, and suddenly I realised it wasn't going to get dark. The other thing that was so common was that it would come up at slideshows later during the winter at Halley Bay when someone would show a picture of an iceberg taken on the way down, a tiny berg on the horizon, because they were exciting then. There's one on the horizon. And, of course, by the time you got close to one, you'd taken a dozen photographs and you didn't bother. So you found all yours were of distant ones.
And the continent itself, when you got to see the scale and the size and the majesty of the Antarctic around the Weddell Sea in that area, did it move you at all, or was it just here we go?
No, I'm afraid my mind is a bit prosaic and not the artistic type. No, other people went into raptures, but I was more matter of fact. But also, Halley Bay was, it is not scenic like the peninsula. I don't know if you've had descriptions from other people there.
Please.
But yes, the ice shelves, which they form all around the Antarctic where conditions are right. But basically, they tend to be about 90 feet above sea level, the surface, and they go down about 600 feet. And they're floating, which means that if you moor on them, there's no obvious tide. But it's just flat on top, and most of the way they're cliffs, the front. This is what Scott called the barrier, because he sailed along it for long distances, and there was no easy way up. The thing about Halley Bay, that's why the base was set up there, there was, you might say, a large crack, perhaps half a mile across, and wind-blown snow had built up into a ramp there, so you could moor the boat at the bottom and drive up the ramp. And you drove up there and onto the surface of the ice shelf, and it was just flat, I won't say as far as you could see, because 30 miles away, if you look carefully, you could see high ground. But it was just flat, and even when you got to the base, there was little other but masts and posts and bits and pieces showing around. And let's say it wasn't as inspiring as some of the photos you see in other parts of mountain series.
Did you have a sense of disappointment then about where you were going to be for the next 2 years?
No. I'd heard about this from, in particular, a chap called Dennis Ardis. Now, Dennis Ardis wasn't a geologist, he was a glaciologist, but he had been with the geologists at Birmingham, so I'd spoken to him a lot. I'd seen his slideshows. He was one of the two first people to sledge to the mountains and set foot on rock there. So, yes, I had heard about this, but as I said, it just wasn't the awe-striking sight that inspiring sight that you would see elsewhere.
Well, let's be a bit more domestic then. What did you make of the conditions and the state of the Halley Base at that point? It wasn't in the best of conditions, was it?
It wasn't as bad as it was a couple of years later. I accepted it as it was. This was just a stepping stone on the way to me. I wanted to do the geology, just as King had been, continental drift. I believed in it. A lot of people didn't. I wanted to go out and help find more evidence, and that was a promising place. And whatever the conditions were there, that was just part of the route I accepted.
So the collapsing roof and the drips and the wet carpets?
There were always discussions from time to time, about whether enough was being spent and things like this. My attitude was, if someone had complained a year or two before and they decided, right, we will save money, they might have saved it by not sending me. And, I would rather put up with the dripping roof. Unfortunately, the year after, a lot of people didn't see things that way, and the next year was very different. But that was my view. Whether others saw it quite as in such an extreme view.
You were there for one season or two seasons?
Well, it's best to count them as winters. I was there for two winters.
So did it deteriorate in your time?
Not greatly, but the attitudes changed. The 60s were a time of great change, both technologically and socially. You have to be very clear about just where you are in the 60s, a year or two one way or another, and a lot of things are different. When we left on the ship, the Beatles, with hair almost touching their ears, this was considered disgraceful, alarming, and no one appeared on the television, no pop singer or pop musician, without a tie and jacket. Things were like that then. You only have to go a year or two on, and suddenly things were starting to loosen. Satire was pretty rare. You got, beyond the fringe, but even that, I think that only came to prominence around then. Up till then, if you ever see any old film recordings of interviews with government ministers or whatever, they are grovelling. This was part of the post-war thing. Discipline had won the war, and you hierarchies, and you kept to it.
So just, can you give me an idea or an example of how attitudes changed in the two years you were at Halley?
Yeah.
How the attitude of the average fit changed towards the living conditions?
It wasn't just the living conditions, it was just sort of cynicism generally. When the boat came in with the new people halfway through, I was out in the mountains and I didn't see them for a couple of months. So quite what their reactions were, I don't know. I've heard this said that they expected hot and cold running water in the bunk rooms. The only running water you would have got was the drips. And the only hot and cold running water we had was in the kitchen, but there was in the washroom. But conditions, yeah, they were pretty Spartan. And they, I'm told they expected more, and from their attitudes, there was also a view expressed at times that they thought we were there for purely political reasons, not scientific. I mean, we'd certainly mentioned that. That came up in our discussions. But we regarded it as it was, there was valuable scientific work. I saw my geological workers going that way. The work on ozone there was what showed about the ozone hole. But the view was that if we were only there for political reasons, and that no one was ever going to pay any attention to the results because they were just a fig leaf, did it matter? Did you have to take that much care over it? Did it matter if you got them or something wrong or made it up or made a hash of it? And there were signs of that at times.
Rebellion, signs of rebellion then in the second year? Was that too strong a word?
There was the base leader, Dudley Jahan, the year before Cuddles, as in Cuddly Dudley. He was introduced to us by that name, and it seemed quite alarmingly intimate, but surprisingly soon you just take it for granted. He was a base leader, and people generally, agreed, obeyed him. His decisions were generally wise, and he knew what he was doing, and he could usually help with things. The next year, it was Phil Cotton. Now, Phil Cotton, he was probably one of the best people there to be the base leader. He was a very diligent, well-meaning person and a very competent engineer, which was his background. He didn't have the charisma that Dudley Jahan had. And people began to question, what does a base leader mean? Can he give orders? Or when a job is to be done, does he have to be the first one in the work party who goes out? Or can he just say, you go out and dig? And I don't know if anyone actually refused to do things, but there was, there was obviously much more tension. There were other reasons behind this too. But partly, I think it was that specific instance that within a year or so they changed the name to the title to base commander. Whether that would have changed things much for Phil, I don't know, for Phil Cotton. But certainly, yes, he had a much greater problem keeping people facing in the right direction.
According to the reports from the time, Cotton was pushing very hard for the base to be rebuilt, wasn't he? In his first base report at the end of his first year, he was saying this base must be rebuilt as fast as possible.
He said, yes. There were several buildings there. It depends how many people you send down, you see, because perhaps it was partly IQSY, the International Quiet Sun Year, that there were more people down there. But when the new hut in 61 was built, the idea was the old one was to be abandoned, and it wasn't. We were still in there. That was my bunk room, was in the loft of that, and it was still being used a year or two later. And, this tended to happen. They then sent down a new office block, but that didn't mean that the old ones were abandoned. They were just allocated to other people. And yes, old huts kept being used. There were other things that were perhaps where there was it was more urgent, and that was the generators, which were on their last legs, but they were definitely they needed a huge amount of attention.
Yeah, there's reference to the ionospheric program being abandoned because the mini generator at Coates failed, and that seems to be a typical of a series of technological disasters, shall we say, that you suffered in those 2 years.
Right, Station Coates. So, yes, for more details, you'd have to interview either Lawrence Dicken or Phil Goodwin. I actually looked into that in some detail because I wrote up a chapter on that, and I hadn't been in touch with Phil Goodwin since 1966. But Lol Dicken, he actually read what I wrote and gave more comments and so on. Yes, they had little petrol generators, which these were nothing like the ones on base, which were diesels. These were just small things, and they broke down. They lasted a few weeks, and for whatever reason, or a month or two. But the point was that they had no real backup, because if anyone had said to them, backup, you know, you would have looked at it the other way and said, look, if the generators won't work, we shouldn't be going there. Their whole idea is to do scientific work with scientific instruments. If there isn't going to be any power, call the whole trip off. So, yes, when these broke down, they found themselves in an uncomfortable situation.
So the three things working together, the technological failures, the condition of the base, the greater expectations of the incoming FIDs, did all that combine to produce a kind of was it a sense of deflation, sense of frustration that was creeping through the base at that time?
Yes, there were. One mustn't take it too far. I mean, there were achievements. There were, there were traditions and catchphrases and so on set up, you know, and fun was had and all sorts. But yes, it was definitely, a less purposeful year or attitude than there had been the year before. Another thing which contributed to this is that when I arrived there, let's say with my year, the first thing we had to do was build a new hut. This is the new office block. Now, pretty well everyone benefited from this, because even those who didn't get offices, and we didn't, but we got the old Met office when the Met men moved there and so on. So it was a bonding experience. It went well. I don't know if you heard of the troubles about the 1961 hut, but pieces, you know, items missing in all sorts and huge quantities. Everything went well. Everything was there. It went according to schedule. It went up fast. And as I said, it was a good experience. The next year, and now I missed the beginning of this because, as I said, I was out in the mountains doing my geology. They had a balloon shed to build. Now, the plans had not arrived. The components had, but not the plans. And they were doing frantic skeds with Stanley, with people trying to explain to them what, you know, but this is a large, complex item and huge numbers of components of funny shapes. The other thing, now this also disillusioned the incoming people. There was a carpenter on base. Yippee, he will do it. Oh no, he won't. He's been sent out to the mountains as a field assistant. Now, here we digress. For those 2 years when I was there, they had not sent down field assistants. In other years and on other bases, they do general assistants, cash hands. They didn't, and therefore someone had to be picked, or two people from other jobs, which presumably they'd been sent down to do because they were needed there. And one of them happened to have been Tony Baker, the builder, who was out there with me and with Di Wild. And so they got a couple of the civil engineers who were in the incoming people, and Munro Sivright, who was the deputy base leader, and he had some knowledge of those such things. And they struggled away. Also, building it did not have the general attraction of the office block, which, as I said, was to everyone's benefit. This was only for the Met men. And on one or two occasions, there was a feeling that they weren't pulling their weight in the shifts that were It was completed, but it was not a happy bonding experience as the other was. If I can just add, there might be another possibility. There's just a possibility that I went in with stars in my eyes and I may have seen it better and there, you know, than I did later. I may have been waking up to one or two things.
The word I was searching for earlier in my senior moment was morale. So what was it, despite all this, that kept morale going?
Well, for a start, there's no alternative. You're there until the next boat comes. You know, it's a unique experience. You can do things that no one else can. Or you can take photographs, you can see things, you have time to do certain hobbies. I mean, I've been to see emperor penguins with their eggs. Now, who knows? The holiday route now, you can actually be flown in to see them in spring with chicks, not with eggs. Probably before long, you'll be able to fly in and see them with eggs. But I don't think anyone's going to allow you to take them back and have scrambled egg when you get home. Mm-hmm. You know, now there's a unique one. No, I think the main thing was that there wasn't any alternative. But it was more, let's say, their views on bass and so on. There were other things. If you read Sir Vivian's book, he tells about morale on base, how it's passed on from one group to the next, you know, and how each group sort of pick up the ethos of the existing ones. And occasionally he says it all goes wrong and the only thing to do is to clear out the lot and send an entirely fresh. I don't know whether he began to see us that way. He couldn't really clear everyone out, but hang on, where was I going with this?
We're talking about morale.
Yeah. No. Oh, yes. Once again, I keep saying this. I was out in the mountains. There were four of us. I was the geologist. Di Wild was the surveyor. We had two assistants. Tony Baker, the joiner, carpenter, and Simon Russell, Russ, the radio operator. So there were four of us there. There were two people at Coates, Phil Goodwin and Lawrence Dixon, Lol Dickon. Now, when the new people came in, if I remember rightly the numbers, I think there were 18 of them coming in and 8 of the there. So, you know, 8 imposing their attitudes on 18 is never going to be easy. And also, just by chance, I think that the people who were there by nature tended to be a more thoughtful group. And the people who came in, they tended to be more extroverts among them. And, you know, I think their attitude, let's say, it wasn't perhaps imposed on the other 8. But it wasn't the other way around. The other 8 couldn't really establish.
They didn't meld.
They did. No, let's say that the 8 could not shape the attitudes of the 18, and you know, to what we had considered normal the year before. Mm. Of course, if you asked one of those people, they might say that we were a dull bovine bunch accepting terrible conditions and poor, bad organisation, accepting it blindly, and we should have, you know, seen what was happening. But one of them can say that when you interview them.
All right. Let's talk a bit about the work, shall we? Because let's move on to positive things. I'm just interested, you talked about King's continental drift theory. Was this still quite early in its concept, continental drift theory, at that point? Are we talking about trying to prove a theory? Were you out there to try and help him prove his theory?
Right. Continental drift is actually, it's over a century old, the first thing that people noted that the shape of South America, if you shoved it across the Atlantic and sort of tucked it under the armpit of West Africa, it fitted nicely. And it was Wegener, a German, who really put this forward. Others had just noticed and mentioned. And he said, look, I think these, you know, they have moved apart. And other people took this up. And before, it was the southern continent, South Africa and Australia, who seemed to be most convinced, because the evidence, the geological evidence, is most clear there. You know, you find one continent here and one there, and the geology is remarkably similar. And you say, if you assume that, it would be easier to explain. And, sorry, I'm gesticulating.
You brought your yeah. hands together, like two continents being yeah. put side by side. Yeah.
Anyway, and but this was in the 20s and 30s. Some people in Britain began to accept it. The Americans were completely against. There was also the question of which way you start. Do you start with a mechanism or with an observation? And I'm afraid here my comparison is with lightning. If Sir Isaac Newton had looked out and seen an electrical storm and said, look at the lightning, in my view, those critics in America would have said, ah, but can you say what causes it? And if you can't say what causes it, you can't believe it. Because that's what they said. They said there was no force known that could move continents about. And the general view was that they were ploughing through the ocean like sort of ships sailing through perhaps an icy sea, whereas, of course, now it's known that they move with part of the ocean plate around them. The mechanism wasn't known. But regardless of the mechanism, as with seeing lightning in the sky, you may not know what causes it, but it's pretty obvious if you're in the southern continent that it's there. And, well, let's say that's how it seemed to King, and that's how it seemed to me and a lot of others.
So what were you doing to prove or disprove this theory? What were you looking for? Basalt, in particular?
Yes, similar sediments. One of the interesting things as a geologist coming here fascinated me was all the fossils. You know, you can find seashells in the limestones and all sorts, because from time to time here
being Britain,
the sea has covered the area and you've had marine deposits. Not in South Africa. In South Africa, when you look at all the sandstones and shales and whatever, pretty well all of them, they were in the middle of a continent. They were fresh water. You know, it was obviously a long way from sea. And this is quite unusual. And secondly, you then find you get much the same in Australia and India and South America. And it does seem, you know, you start to wonder, where was the sea? This all seems to have been in the middle of a big continent. And secondly, they all seem to be similar in this. And the basalts were distinctive, but also the sandstones below them and the fossils. There was a fossil leaves called Glossopteris. They look a little bit like a rounded eucalyptus leaf, elongated, but they're very distinctive in the southern continents. And these two, they seem to be the flora of a southern continent, but not of a northern one. And they were the kind of things that I would be looking for. Although, obviously, you try not to go out with preconceived ideas. You go and map what you see, but you're hoping for what you are going to see.
So what did he find?
Quite astonishingly, one of the very first things I ran into was the basalt. And in my final year at university, our five people in our final class, we went for a week or so up in the Drakensberg in South Africa, Natal, and hiking through these basalts. And suddenly I found myself, you know, and these looked exactly like the ones that I'd seen there about 2 years earlier. An amusing sideline there. I'd gone to this place because there were some aerial photos taken by the Norwegians or Norwegian British Swedish expedition 10 years earlier. And I could see this area looked black. And I actually thought it might be dolerite. And I went up there. This was one of the first things I did when I moved into this area to see it. And it turned out to be the basalts I was after. But also, the weather was miserable up there. This was still spring. And the surveyors, who were 4,000 feet lower down, they on the radio skids, they were saying about sledging and shirt sleeves. And You know, it was cold and miserable and blowing. I got the samples. I went off and came back later, you know, in the height of summer for a better look. But we found those. We did find fossils.
You did or didn't?
We did find one patch. That was actually the next season. But there were enough to, let's say, to show... to correlate quite clearly with other similar Southern Hemisphere examples. In fact, they were sent to a lady in South Africa, Edna Plumstead, who was the acknowledged expert on these things.
Well, were you finding flora or fauna fossils?
Flora. There were what were called trace fossils. These are where on the bedding planes, the surface of the rock, you find... you find little lines and tracks where some invertebrates have crawled or crept or whatever. Sometimes there seem to be little foot prints on the sides of it. You never find the creature that made them, but you can speculate. We did see some of those, or I should really say I, because although there was always an assistant with me, you know, he was just there ready for safety and assistance. I was the only geologist in that area. So, but the plants, there was coal in one area, coal beds, but although there were plant fossils there, they were all fragmental. Basically, they looked like lawn clippings, and, you know, they were just too fragmental to be of any use for identification. The difficult thing was to find a place where there were good clear examples.
Did you have a sense of excitement about you whilst all this was going on, or was this all routine?
Wow, yes. you know, I mean, finding the basalt at an early stage, also the first time I got onto the sandstones there, which were similar to the ones that, you know, I'd studied as a student and also as a schoolboy I'd known well. Yes, there was that. There was another thing. That when we started, when we reached the mountains, the idea was that the geologist from the year before... His name was Dick Worsfold. He would finish off. He'd got a few things to round off, and I would work with him as an assistant and just pick up techniques for operating in that area, both sledging, you know, and climbing and that sort of thing. And so the very first day we set off, we and up this mountain, we up a ridge, up the corner of it, which was a scramble, but not no worse than that. And, you know, I kept stopping to look at this and hammer at that and examine. And he kept shouting at me to keep up. And a year later, I found the same thing, you know, someone who was there helping me. And he told later how he, the memory of this, you know, how exciting that first day was on rock. Yes, fascinating.
You mentioned a geology office, which I guess was rudimentary, I suspect. How yes. much? How much work could you do on the samples before you sent them back to the UK?
Well, you say sent them back. We didn't send them back for anything else. They came back with us and we worked with them ourselves. They apart from things, specialised things like the plant fossils, those were then, I bundled those up and sent them to South Africa to Edna Plumstead. The main thing you could do was make what we call thin sections. This is where you grind it down so it's 30 microns thick, and you look at through it with a microscope and polarized light, and you can identify quite a lot. Now, when Dick Worsfold came back this would be my first autumn, he'd been in the field when I arrived. He came back with some of his samples, and he wanted to examine them to give a lead to what. Any things he should check on in the next season. And we polished these things. We polished them by hand. There's a picture of Scotsmen doing exactly the same thing. And we had no motor-driven abrasives or wheels or whatever. So what you did, you just rubbed this thing with your fingers on a glass plate with carborundum and ground and ground and ground. I forget how... I don't know, we may have turned out one a day or something like that. But you've got a winter. There's nothing much, not much else to do.
Is there any more you want to say about the geology before we move on to other things?
Geology.
At the end of it, were you more or less convinced by King's?
Oh, I always had been. I mean, if you want me to just give a quick example from South Africa, not the Antarctic, where I grew up, where I went to university around Durban, if you look at the rock formations there, there's the Table Mountain sandstone, which is a couple of thousand, about 1,000 feet thick, I think. The Dwyker Tillite, which is a glacial deposit, which is a couple of thousand feet thick. There's the Ecker beds above that, the sands, shale and the sandstone, each a few thousand feet thick. And then the basalts. And because of the way things are faulted in here and there, you can see them in all positions. And none of these are tapering out as if they are coming to an end. And it's the kind of thing that does show when it happens. The continental shelf there is only about 10 miles wide and whew, down into the deep ocean. So, you know, did everything suddenly taper off with no sign of it? Over hundreds of millions of years, many tens, and something had broken off. There was no other explanation for it. And there are a few places where it's as obvious. But no, I was convinced. Yes.
Let's take a short break.
Yes, indeed.
And we'll have some more tea and then we'll come back and talk some more.